Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After 2 years of a civil war that has killed tens of thousands and forced more than a million refugees to flee the country, the Syrian conflict appears to have entered an even more vicious and dangerous phase, with allegations of chemical warfare, reports of civilian massacres, and an apparent Israeli airstrike near Damascus that prompted threats of retaliation. The chemical weapons charges have increased pressure on the U.S. to take some kind of action, particularly since President Obama once said any such attacks would cross a red line, prompting a robust U.S. response. So far, however, the president is resisting calls to arm rebel groups that are attempting to bring down Syrian President Assad. On Capitol Hill, that has prompted some frustration, notably from Senator John McCain, who describes the president's red line as written in invisible ink. But the Obama administration worries American weapons could fall into the wrong hands. Instead, it's announced an increase in humanitarian aid and diplomatic efforts, including working with Russia. Today in The Exchange, with so much happening in Syria and so much conversation about what the U.S. should do, if anything, we're taking some time this hour to just catch up on this story, and let's hear from you. Your questions, thoughts, personal observations, if you have connections to Syria, are all welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And we have three guests with us for the hour. Wayne Lesperance is here, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement. And Wayne, thanks a lot for your time. I know you're busy. Wayne, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks a lot, Wayne, for being with
Thank
us.
You.
With us in studio, Sarwar Kashmiri, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center for International Security, adjunct professor at Norwich University. Sarwar's book is called NATO 2.0. And Sarwar, welcome and thanks for making the trip.
Thank you for calling me.
Also with us, Bill Martell, associate professor of international security studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. His most recent book is called Victory in War. And Bill, welcome back. Good to see you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
Well, and Bill, turn to you first. Just before we get into all the headlines from this week, and it's getting pretty scary over there, put Syria in the context of the broader so-called Arab Spring that started more than 2 years ago. How Syria fits into that whole picture?
Yeah, Laura, it's what we in the United States and really in the world confront is a situation in the last couple of years in the Middle East where a number of regimes that are by any account authoritarian, repressive in to varying extents, and also sit astride probably the greatest reserves of oil in the world, have been going through this process of democratization. And we saw this in Tunisia, we saw it in Morocco, we've seen it in Egypt, we saw it in Libya. And I tend to think, but this is a mixed, this is an issue, and I'm sure Sarwar and Wayne will have other views. We have to wonder how far other major regimes are from experiencing this process. And I think of UAE, I think of Saudi Arabia, I think of Qatar, I think of the GCC states, the Gulf Cooperation Council states. So the big issue for American foreign policy is, we can't support any. How can we not support democratization, freedom, and human rights? So for rhetorically, we really want to support this in a, I think, bipartisan sense. The downside is that, and Egypt is the dangerous case, Libya's right in there, is they have turned into repressive authoritarian regimes that are as far removed now as they were 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago from freedom, democracy, and human rights.
Yeah, so it hasn't really worked out.
It hasn't
the way
worked
people
out.
Hoped.
But we remain eternally optimistic, I suppose, although I think we're getting a little bit more nervous. So it's in this context that we look at events in Syria. I know we'll get to that. So now we have this process, this blooming of democracy in the Middle East, but it's not really blooming and it's not really democracy, but we see this sort of restive political activity going on in the Middle East. And this is the problem we confront now.
Yeah, so you too, Sarwar, put Syria in this bigger picture for us, please.
Well, I agree entirely with what Bill has said. The only thing I would add is that what makes it even more complex for the United States is that after the long war with Iraq and after all our engagements in the Middle East, we stand now, the U.S. does, with very little credibility, with a very de- with very little credibility with the Muslim population, with the countries in the Middle East. They see us supporting dictatorships, as Bill said. And so when we come to Syria, there really are very few opportunities. And the umbrella issue there is that there is really no vital American interest involved in Syria.
Well, and I want to get to American interests for sure, because that's a big part of this. But what about Syria itself, Sarwar? For example, you know, this process, and Bill put a good point on it, that, you know, there were a lot of hopes. It hasn't worked out in each instance for sure. But it's taken a long time in Syria. I mean, this has been going on for more than 2 years.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. About 100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt was in Egypt, and there was a nascent freedom movement there. And when he spoke at Cairo University, the students said, "We want freedom. We want independence from British colonial rule." And Teddy Roosevelt reminded them that democracy and freedom doesn't come in weeks, months, years, decades. It comes after years. It may be a century before you learn how to do democracy. So we've forgotten that. And all of these changes that that are bubbling up are far, far away from fruition. And Syria is going through that, and Syria will continue to go through that. So that's what we need to keep in mind, patience. And American involvement, in my opinion, will only delay that.
Well, and again, we'll get to that in just a minute, but a little more on Syria, Wayne, as well. Just remind us, if you could, of the sort of ethnic and religious culture in Syria, because in Iraq and in other countries, that's been really important. In Iraq, for example, it was said that the U.S. maybe didn't appreciate initially that this was a country of Shiite, Sunnis, and Kurds who sometimes got along and sometimes didn't. So just remind us of that religious and ethnic background in Syria, Wayne.
Sure, and I think that's one of the distinguishing issues here from, say, for example, the Egyptian experience. You have something akin to what has been called a confessional system emerging in a very strong way in this conflict in Syria. That is, you have Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims who have differences of views on how things ought to be. The country is run by a group of called the Alawites, which is sort of an ethnic and religious group, which is very much a minority, about 10 to 12% of the population sort of running the rest of the country. So you have the basis for religious differences. You have some tribal differences in Syria at work. And it seems to me that the more other groups come in, like Hezbollah, and I know we'll get to all of this, that are emphasizing a particular worldview, the more likely we're going to see this conflict become much more along these religious, this confessional lines, which is not something that's easy to navigate for the United States. And I completely agree with what Sarwar and Bill have said about U.S. involvement. It's complex, and I think you're right that we sort of had trouble with it initially, especially in Iraq. I don't anticipate we wouldn't have trouble with it in Syria, which is another reason why the president is taking his time on deciding on, you know, what exactly we do, if anything, to arm rebels against the government.
Well, and speaking of arming rebels, I want to ask you, Wayne, and also you, Bill. So, Wayne, who are these rebels who are fighting against President Assad?
There's sort of two groups. I mean, there's the way I like to think of it is there's the political arm, right, and then there's the military arm. And so we focus on a group called the Syria National Coalition, who President Assad of Syria refers to as terrorists. This is sort of the political wing. Then on the ground, there's the Free Syrian Army. But those are the two that we sort of like. There is another group called the al-Nusra Front, which is, we believe is heavily influenced and populated by al-Qaeda fighters. There are other groups in the country, Hezbollah, which is largely from Lebanon, supported by Iran, that are helping the government. So, you know, there are a number of actors on the ground that, you know, we have, I would say, very little confidence in, you know, being able to say we really know what their agenda is. And by the way, are they, you know, are they really pro-West, pro-American, pro-democracy? And this is really why it becomes difficult to decide whether or not we put arms in their hands and what kinds of arms we'll put in their hands. It's very fresh on the minds of Americans, the experience in Afghanistan, not the most recent one, but the arming of the Mujahideen, because eventually those weapons end up in the hands of people that are shooting against our interests. And so there's a real concern that we not end up arming a group that is ultimately not friendly to the United States.
So, Bill, all these different groups that Wayne describes, are they working together with the common goal of defeating Assad, or is everybody just fighting each other?
The thumbnail sketch that I use to capture this is we've got two groups, and I think Wayne covered it very nicely. One, there are those who are legitimately appalled by and opposed to and seek to take down an authoritarian, repressive regime of President Bashar al-Assad. And there's very little disagreement on that issue. The second group are what I would call the opportunists and extremists. They see a critical part of the world. They see a civil war unfolding. They see the West dithering as to whether or not to provide support. And they are in this both to help destabilize Syria. Their end game probably, and I'm generalizing a little bit, but I don't think it's a bad generalization. Their end game would be to see a more radicalized kind of Syria. So now we have this clash. So here's the dilemma for the United States. We have people legitimately want to take down a regime that's terrible. I mean, a really oppressive, authoritarian regime. On the other hand, a bunch of what we now, the euphemism in the popular press is the bad guys who are out there trying to destabilize this regime with an eye toward
broader destabilization,
broader
control for themselves,
broader extremist agenda. And that's the sticky wicket, as the Brits would say, into which we find ourselves. Because if we provide assistance, which we'll get to, it could go to the good people trying to take down a bad regime. It could go to the bad guys that have broader extremist agendas.
Are they working together, Bill? Do we know?
I don't know that we know. Sarah may want to jump in on this. I don't know that we know. I think there are so many different groups that there's going to be lots of side deals that people are working on to promote this to push this revolution further.
So I want to jump in real quick.
Just to add to this, what has made it even more complicated is that the so-called Islamist side of it are the ones who are receiving most of the weaponry and the ammunition. And the quote-unquote good guys, not a term I fully agree with, are the ones who are really not getting the weapons and so on. So just last week, there was an attack by the Syrian forces, which recaptured a lot of territory because the non-Islamist fighters simply ran out of ammunition. And so that makes the whole thing very complicated as we go forward.
All right. And we will start taking your phone calls, emails, Facebook comments. After a short break, the number for you to join us here in the exchange with your questions or comments is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR brings you the news every day, all year long. News from around the world, across the country, and throughout the state. Breaking news, developing stories, weather, and sports. NHPR, keeping New Hampshire connected. More on rising worry over Syria coming up on The Exchange at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. What can be done to stop sexual assault in the military? Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, working to create opportunity and transform lives across the Granite State. Your community's loan fund. Details at communityloanfund.org. From Union Institute and University Brattleboro, offering the doctorate in psychology, a blended program combining weekend and online coursework. Information at myunion.edu. And Granite State Symphony Orchestra presenting a Spring Pops concert on May 11th at 7 for an evening of Strauss waltzes and a silent auction at Concord City Auditorium, gsso.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at recent developments this week in the Syrian civil war, a situation many say has gone from bad to worse. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. As we take some time this hour to just catch up on this complicated story, we want your questions, your thoughts, your own observations. If you've got personal connections to Syria, they're all welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Also, your thoughts on what you think the U.S. should do in this country, if anything. That's a big debate going on right now in Washington. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Sarwar Kashmiri, Wayne Lesperance, Bill Martell. A couple more questions before we go to our listeners. And one of them, I think, Wayne Lesperance, was a huge headline this week. Pretty stunning. Israel gets involved in this. Now, what happened, Wayne? A colleague of mine said, Israel, what are they doing?
Well, you know, as we know, Israel shares a border with Syria. Israel has a history with Syria that is, you know, not all that pleasant. And this specific incident was based on the Israeli calculation that Hezbollah, this group in Syria, which is a, you know, largely a proxy organization, terrorist organization for Iran, was moving weapon systems. And there was some concern that there were some fairly advanced weapon systems, some missiles, and the Israelis launched a strike to destroy them. So, you know, the immediate reaction to that is the Israelis are doing what the Israelis do. They're not going to sit back and allow, you know, a dangerous situation to metastasize. They're going to go and take it out before it becomes, you know, more of a threat to them. Beyond that, the implications of this are really problematic, and not the least of which is now Assad has a new chip to play in this whole conversation. When he talks to his population, he says, look, you know, the world is against us here. The Israelis, clearly there's a plot to unseat a legitimate Arab regime, he would say. And, you know, the Israelis are involved. This makes it even harder now for the United States to become involved because it looks, you know, very much like there's a U.S.-Israeli, you know, conspiracy is the kind of language we'll hear from the Middle East. To undermine, you know, the Syrian regime.
Well, and here's a question maybe for you, Bill. How did the turmoil in Syria, perhaps, and obviously you're not in the heads of Israeli decision makers, but how do you think that might have affected their decision making around this, if at all? For example, you know, would they have done this no matter what was going on in Syria? Is it easier for them to do this, given that there's so much turmoil in Syria right now? What do you think?
Israel faces a really tough, and Wayne put it, I think, nicely and euphemistically, really faces a tough neighborhood.
Absolutely.
And it's a very difficult situation. And Israeli policy, and everyone has their views as to whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing. But the Israeli view for a long time has been that you don't wait for problems to emerge, you deal with them before they hit you. And so as Wayne put it, I think, very nicely, the Israelis saw weapon systems moving into an area that could be used against Israel. So I think Israeli policy generally for decades has been to preempt against these kinds of circumstances.
This is not unusual.
This is not at all unusual. And one can draw one's own judgments, but if it's facing you across the border and it's something that it can hit and kill your people, your women, children, men, women, and children, it's something that you tend to move quickly against.
So did the fact that there's all this going on in Syria, did that make it easier for Israel to do this because there's so much else going on now? Or did it provide, as Wayne put, an opportunity for Assad to kind of pump it up?
I think by most accounts, Assad is not irrelevant, but his political utility is declining. The Russian, there's a little bit of daylight. Now, whether it's atmospheric or not, we don't know. Daylight between the Russians and Syria. More coordination between the U.S. and Russia on these kinds of things, but we've seen this before. So I think I think this is an Israeli issue in any case that they would deal with, and I think they simply view Assad as, and others have made the same comment, as probably a politically dying commodity in that part of the world. I don't know that anyone, Sarwar and Wayne may have their own views. I'm skeptical that 5 years from now we'll see Bashar al-Assad in charge of Syria. It could be totally wrong, but that's kind of my gut as to where we are. And I think that's a growing American, Russian, EU, Middle Eastern view on the matter.
Sarwar, what do you think? How do you think the Obama administration feels about what Israel did this week?
excuse me. One of the points I wanted to make right before I move into that is that as of this morning, the reports from both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times that the Russians are about to ship sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles to Syria. So that complicates the picture.
To Syria,
even,
in
to
favor
Syria.
Of the Syrian government.
Exactly.
And after
these
talking
are,
to the Obama administration
These are
about
very sophisticated radar-guided anti-aircraft missiles, which will make it even more difficult for another Israeli strike and for American intervention. As far as the question that you just asked me as to what the Obama administration is feeling about it, I think that Mr. Obama, Mr. Hagel, Mr. Kerry, Mr. Biden are pretty much all together on the fact that it would be very difficult to intervene in Syria, that the U.S. has few national interests there, and they're trying to grapple now with the politics of it, because with Israel having done what they did, there are people who are saying, gee, well, if the Israelis are going in, then the U.S. should go in too. So that's what makes the American issue complicated. And I'll just end by saying that if you looked at the Russian media this morning, the Syria story was low down in priority. It was even lower than a report from the University of Houston that an armed citizen project is saying that they'd like to distribute free shotguns in 15 cities to see if crime will go down. That's how the Russian media is reporting the story. I just thought I'd mention that to put some perspective.
And yet the headline you mentioned, small though it was or downplayed though it was, Sarwar, is huge because this week also, Bill, Russia played nice with the president, right? Yes, we want peace in Syria, and yes, let's work together. And now they're shipping major weaponry, as Sarwar
That's why my
us.
Last comment, I slipped in that little comment about the Russians. We've seen this before with the Russians, that they try to play nice with Washington, but then they end up supporting Assad. And the Russian, as Sarwar mentioned, both the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, I think the Wall Street Journal in particular, said that the Russian government had declined to comment on the reports that, in fact, these new advanced surface-to-air missile systems were being sold to, actually under a deal for which the Syrians have been paying for several years, were being transferred to Syria.
Let's take some comments from our listeners, gentlemen,
sure.
And lots more to dig into. Our number here in the exchange for you to join us with your thoughts, comments about what's been happening in Syria, your questions, too, if you just want a better understanding of what's happening in that country. We welcome your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Also, what do you think the U.S. should do with the situation if anything? Limited involvement, no involvement, humanitarian involvement. What do you think? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, a couple emails have come in kind of saying the same thing. Here's one in from Robert in Walpole. The Syria situation is in fact a religious war between Sunni and Shiites. Why on earth should the USA get involved in that? If Baptists and Catholics in the U.S. started fighting each other, would we expect France and England to interfere? That's from Robert in Walpole. And then here's another one from Lori, who says, time for America to smarten up, realize we don't need to solve all the problems of the world, nor can we participate in all the wars of the world. Stay out of Syria, says Lori. Wayne Lesperance, what do you think? Two listeners both saying, no way. Stay out.
And I think that's exactly what President Obama says every morning when he gets up and reads the National Intelligence Report. And, you know, there's no easy answers for the U.S. And I think we'll get into what options there might be out there. But here's the argument, right? If you're interested in Time magazine this week, there's a really nice back and forth between Zbigniew Brzezinski and John McCain on, you know, pro and con of intervention in Syria. And McCain's argument is he's making a moral argument. He's saying America's values are at stake here, and there are 70,000 casualties. 70,000 people have been killed in Syria. There are 5 million refugees. There are 2 million children facing malnutrition, disease, and trauma. This conflict is threatening to spill over into places like Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon and Israel, obviously. The potential for this becoming a much more serious problem on a much broader scale is there. But beyond that, it says something in McCain's mind for the United States to stand back and watch as 70,000 people have been killed, and with more to come, clearly, where chemical weapons have allegedly been used, and do nothing. And so, aside from providing, you know, non-lethal aid. So that's the argument, that, you know, we as America stand for something, and that, you know, that's something is commending us to action. Now, in my view, that sounds great, but I want to know what the specific plan is, because we are exhausted. We have very little credibility in the region. And I'm not sure that the United States, despite our great capacity and capability, can affect the kind of change we would like to see or that John McCain would like to see in the region. So that, you know, that's sort of the back and forth on the moral versus practical argument of whether or not the U.S. should get involved directly.
So here's a quick question for you, Wayne, and then I want to get our guys in studio, too. Those arguments that you made, humanitarian arguments, the spillover arguments, the refugee arguments, those won the day in terms of Libya, and the U.S. did get involved through NATO, no boots on the ground, but, you know, NATO warplanes were heavily involved and said to have helped the Libyan rebels turn the corner. So why don't those arguments hold water in Syria, Wayne?
Well, for one thing, we haven't been able to assemble the coalition to get involved in the way they did in Libya. I suspect that if there is going to be some sort of direct U.S. military involvement, you know, whatever that looks like, the only way it happens is through some sort of a coalition effort. And whether that's NATO or the U.N., much less likely that it's through the U.N. because the Russians would veto such an effort, I don't know. And I think that's the problem. There's a real political problem here on how to get the ducks in a row to coordinate a coalition involvement in Syria. That's the first problem. Then there's the real practical issue. We know domestically in the United States there's absolutely no stomach for any significant involvement in a place like Syria. And by the way, Laura, I would just challenge the assumption a little bit. You know, while we understand boots on the ground to mean large numbers of U.S. military personnel, there were American boots on the ground. We know this because we know what happened in Benghazi after. We know this because we know that
in Libya,
In Libya. There were U.S. Special Forces operators operating in country. So it's a much smaller footprint, but American lives are at stake. And again, back to what the callers are saying, this really is becoming a sectarian conflict, and it's not clear who our dog is in this fight.
All right. Well, Lori and Robert, thanks for those emails. You can email us, too, if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. First up is Sasha in Kittery, Maine. Hi, Sasha. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I was just wondering why, it seems to me like the United States is condemned no matter what we do. If we go into Syria, we're condemned by other countries. If we don't do anything, other countries condemn us for not helping. And I was wondering if, we never asked, did Canada do enough, or can other countries do enough? And do I feel that just because I'm in the United States, or do other countries see America in this way, like condemned no matter what we do?
You know, Sasha, this is a great, great point. Two good points, actually. Bill, what do you think? No matter what we do, we're going to be criticized for sure.
You know, Sasha, that's a great point and thought. President, I've said this on the show many times. President Truman, you say he wish he had one-handed economists. Economists say on the one hand, the other hand. On the one hand, we feel a strong imperative to help people that are having a difficult time. And as you put it, Sasha and others have put it, when you look at the human cost of what's going on in Syria, it tugs at the American heartstrings. On the other hand, the danger is that we have very little public support for this. I just last night pulled off some polling data, which goes precisely what Robert and Lori said on email. Right now, 50% of the American people say, do not – this is a Rasmussen poll, which polls a little to the right, but still. 50% of the United States should leave the situation in Syria alone. And the other poll that came out at the same time said 42% of the Americans polled said do not provide aid and assistance to whatever group's activities within Syria. So our problem is if we do nothing, we're accused of being indifferent to a terrible humanitarian crisis. And if we do nothing as well, and this blows up into a wider war, we have Turkey, we have Iran, we have Israel, we have Syria, we have Iraq, that is not too far removed to imagine a regional conflagration.
There's no good choices.
There's none. This is the classic, the only good choices you have are bad choices. But I would imagine policymakers in Washington, President Obama and others, are looking at this polling data and saying, they clearly have no appetite to get involved in this for a bunch of good reasons. I think the odds of us getting involved militarily are very small unless something dramatic blows up.
Yeah, Sarah, go ahead.
Well, Sasha has a really key point here, and I want to play Sasha a bit of a contrarian. I suspect that a large part of the world, the majority of the peoples in the world, really would like to see America stay out of it, because I think most of the world believes that America gets involved because of this notion of we must lead everywhere, get involved everywhere. And I don't fully buy the moral argument. You know, if you take the Syrian civil war, it's now about 3 years old. In the same time period, 80,000 people have been killed in Somalia. Most of them were women, or a lot of them were women and children. Right? Now, that's a place where we could have intervened and make a lot of difference without people fighting at us. But I didn't hear any, or we haven't heard any great calls for intervention. So I think the moral argument is very hollow. And I think we all tend to forget that this is really a much bigger power block issue of Russia and China and Iran and Lebanon trying to maneuver to put America and everyone else in balance. So I do agree with you that we will be praised, but I think we can overdo that.
What do you mean overdo that?
In the sense that I don't believe that the world is clamoring for American intervention. I mean, I don't believe that countries are jumping up and down and say, America, you know, invade. And when you look at these countries, I just want to remind Sasha and your listeners that these countries are all less than 100 years old. They were created by Britain and France not to have democracies but for colonial ends. And so now they're going through their civil war, just like America went through a civil war to find itself. So that's what I mean by overdoing it. I think the only people who are jumping up and down and saying, go in, are the same people who always want to see America involved all over the world. And I think that that time has ended.
Okay. Sasha, thanks a lot for the call. I love her point, too, about, you know, no one's complaining that Canada isn't doing enough. So thank you for calling in, Sasha. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Okay, so Wayne Lesperance, if we can make an assumption, and I think maybe we can, that nobody wants an Iraq-style American involvement, lots of boots on the ground and so forth, what might be some smaller options that Capitol Hill or the White House are looking at in terms of making a bad situation not so bad in Syria?
Well, I don't think that would be the calculation.
Are there limited options? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
There are limited options. So, you know, what I think the debate right now is, and we're hearing some Republicans coming out and calling for arming the Free Syrian Army, providing them with weapon systems that would give them a better shot. And, you know, I think Sarwar mentioned earlier, there are instances in which they literally lose ground because they run out of ammunition, they run out of materiel. That's something that, you know, presumably Washington can intervene with and make a difference in terms of arming these rebels. The question then becomes is what sorts of arms do we give them? Do we give them sophisticated arms in which they shoot down aircraft where they can destroy tanks and other heavy weapons? That is of concern because those in the wrong hands can be used against, you know, civilian targets and other things of interest to us. In terms of other options, I mean, some of the ones that we talk about aside from arming the rebels are declaring a no-fly zone over the country in which a coalition of nations would basically impose a no-fly zone. They would shoot down any Syrian aircraft that went up in the air. Another, perhaps more escalated approach would be to target Syrian chemical weapons facilities or Scud missile sites, their missile systems that would deliver those weapons, and destroy them, which would take that option away from the Syrians. That's dangerous because there's always the risk you don't get them. And lots of other risks associated with that. There is the idea of indicting Assad for war crimes, right? This has come up from a number of areas to just further add, you know, more pressure to him to get out. And then the idea of having some sort of broad United Nations sanctions against Syria, which would very likely be vetoed by the Russians and the Chinese. So, you know, for every option I give you, I can think of at least one, if not more, problems with that option that makes it very hard to either implement or makes it hard for it to be effective.
Okay.
The only game change, really quickly, Laura, that we could anticipate.
Actually, Wayne, I'm going to have you hold off on that thought, and we will get back to it right after a super short break. So stay right here.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Cole Gardens in Concord, offering annuals and perennials from their own sustainable greenhouses in Loudoun, helping you decorate with living color, colegardens.com. And from Cedarcrest Center for Children with Disabilities, enriching the lives of children with complex medical and developmental needs and supporting their families, cedarcrestcenter.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
What people say in the public square is important for citizens to know about.
Which is why you turned to NHPR and Josh Rogers, senior political reporter.
I do my best to pay attention to what public officials say and do, to hold public officials to some account.
New Hampshire's newsroom, covering New Hampshire's political news. NHPR and NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us with the stories that caught your attention this week at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the Syrian civil war as it seemed to enter a more dangerous and volatile phase this week. Debate rages in the U.S. over what, if anything, this country should do in that nation. The number for you to join us with your questions, comments, thoughts, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, before we go back to our listeners, Wayne L'Esperance, just before the break, you were talking about limited options that the U.S. could do, from arming some rebel groups to imposing a no-fly zone to targeting chemical weapons facilities to putting President Assad on trial for crimes against humanity. And you were starting to say, Wayne, but for all of those options, even though they are limited, there's good arguments to not even do that.
That's right. I mean, they all have problems, significant problems, and so that's sort of why we are where we are. You know, everybody clamored for the president to react swiftly after the allegation of chemical weapons use. He had talked about there being a red line or a game changer, and the reality is that if there was a good option, if there was something that we could do immediately that would be meaningful and have the desired outcome that we wanted, we would have done it. And I really believe that. The reality is these options, there are very, very few good options in the country.
All right, let's take another call. And John's calling from Biddeford. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Hey guys. I just wanted to tell you that I believe we're back in the wrong dog in this fight, because when Assad falls, this is not going to be a democracy. There's going to be Islamic groups like al-Nusra that are stronger than the Free Syrian Army, that are better fighters. They're going to take over, and they're going to make Islamic law. And when they do, it's going to be an organization that's against the United States. And I don't like Assad, but unfortunately, he's a better option than what is most likely going to take over Syria after he's gone.
John, given how you feel, and good comments, and I'm sure that's a fear that a lot of people have, given that you feel that way, what do you think the Obama administration and Congress should do?
I don't think we should do anything, and we should allow the Russians to continue to supply all their good equipment, and hopefully, because you know when that guy went over there and he talked to the Russians this week, the Russians said, we're afraid that Islamists are going to take over. That's a practical fear. That's a real practical fear, because the best fighters on the ground, it ain't the guys that are in the Free Syrian Army at all. It's okay. Al-Nusra.
John, thanks a lot for calling in. And boy, what do you think, Sarwar, about the concerns that John has, and I'm sure others share?
Hey, John is a brother on the show. He thinks exactly like I do. The only point, John, that I would want you to think about is this idea that a Muslim country that Syria may become is necessarily bad. I would remind you that the largest Muslim populations in the world are not in the Middle East. They're in Indonesia, they're in Malaysia. Both of those are democracies. Both of those are very friendly to America. So the idea, this notion that a Muslim country automatically becomes something terrible is not necessarily true. So I agree with 90% of what you said, and I just urge you to think a little bit about the rest.
But wait, he's basing that judgment partly based on who the Islamic fighters are in these countries and you know, questioning whether they are sort of peace-loving Malaysian types.
Well, but the point that I would then make is that we are all taking for granted that Mr. Sadat will cease to exist very shortly. Now, that may well be true, and things are pointing to that. But I would also urge us to think that Mr. Assad may last this out, that he may win the civil war. I was talking to a group of soldiers last week, and a Marine said, sir, can you explain to me why Mr. Assad should not fight with everything he's got to preserve his country? I thought that was a very interesting question coming from a Marine. So I wouldn't write off Mr. Sadat just yet. And yes, al-Nusra is there, which is a fanatical type of organization.
But that's what John was talking about. Yeah.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that they're the ones who are going to be in power there, because we have a lot of countries surrounding Syria, a lot of water to flow under the bridge.
So you think that Assad could stay in power even after all this?
I think so. He's still got, although it's dropping, he still has substantial support. The minorities in Syria are concerned that if Mr. Sadat falls.
But you keep saying Sadat. You mean Assad.
I'm sorry, Assad. If Mr. Assad falls, that they will be in trouble. So I don't think it's a given that Mr. Assad is gone already. I think probability is high that he is, but I wouldn't count him out.
Wow. Okay, John, thanks for the call. Bill, you said earlier that you that in 5 years you don't think Assad will be there.
I think, like Sarah, I think it's – I don't want to say that he absolutely won't be there. I think it's less likely he'll survive. I think the critical issue, though, is Russia. If Russia continues to provide the support, continues to veto UN Security Council resolutions putting pressure on Syria, Assad may survive this sort of thing. I agree with the analysis that there is no overwhelming American interest in getting involved in this, except for one factor. It is not in American interest if the Middle East – goes into a period of high instability and chaos. And I think that's what I think is the core worry among on people on all sides of this issue, whether in the States or Europe or the Middle East or elsewhere.
Although some people would say, Bill, and you know what I'm going to say here, some people would say U.S. involvement may increase instability and chaos.
And I am not arguing for...
It's not a given that U.S. involvement tamps down tensions.
I agree. And I'm not actually saying... That's not a subtle argument for we should get involved. I don't think we should do that sort of thing. I think probably the scenario that's best for us is some form of providing assistance. But there's lots of downsides to doing that. But I think from a strategic point of view, if we watch this unfold and it begins to create greater instability in the Middle East, this will come back to hurt us in dramatic ways. Now, one footnote to that. If, as all the projections indicate, in the next 6, 8, 10 years, the United States will become a net energy exporter, our strategic interest in the Middle East may start waning, which has all kinds of consequences. It's a separate show, but it's an issue that we at least have to start thinking about a little bit.
Yeah, that's real interesting. And Sarwar made the point earlier that, you want to talk humanitarian crises, you can look elsewhere for humanitarian crises as well, Somalia and so forth. John, thanks for the points and for adding in today. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Wayne Lesperance, I want to return to something that you mentioned earlier, and that was the allegation this week by a UN official that chemical weapons had been used in Syria. But it's not really clear, Wayne, if that really happened, who did it, what it was. Can you clarify at all on that, Wayne, for us, please?
Yeah, so there is some debate over whether it was used in some circles. Some of the European countries have come out, and they believe, based on their understanding of what happened, that they were, in fact, chemical weapons, sarin gas, was, in fact, used. The United States, Hagel has said, the Secretary of Defense has said, that he believes it was used. The administration has sort of tacitly backed that up, but wants more information. The problem is it's hard to collect that information. It's hard to get in on the ground, conduct an investigation, because there's a shooting war going on.
Sure, absolutely.
It's really difficult to know what exactly has happened. There's also an allegation that the rebels have detonated a chemical weapon, and that's been somewhat dismissed, particularly by Washington. So we're not clear. The trickiness of this all is the politics around it, because the President Obama, has said that would be there's a red line that would cross, that would be a game changer, a deal breaker, and that it would force the United States to do something. What that something is, we're not exactly clear on, and they're clearly debating it. But that's it in a nutshell. This idea that we know the Syrians have these weapons, that the Syrians can use them. And by the way, the scariest scenario of Assad losing power is that, those months before that happens, he becomes desperate and seeks to broaden the conflict by using those weapons in a way that will draw other countries in. That's where it gets really, really scary and messy, and could drag the United States into something it doesn't want to be involved in.
Yeah, and if Assad falls and someone else gets into power, who knows what they will do with those chemical weapons, right?
That's right. I mean, we're seeing a lot of articles being written these days about, what if al-Qaeda gets a chemical weapon? And that's sort of one of those nightmare scenarios that Bill and I have been talking about on your shows for years.
Wow. Okay. And Bill, go ahead. And then Sarwar, this red line problem for President Obama and the world, really.
A couple of comments. One, in foreign policy and diplomacy, never, ever, this is a classic statement, two rules about red lines. One, never make a red line statement unless you really mean to back it up. Rule two, when in doubt, refer to rule one. And so that was a strategic mistake to make that declaration. And I understand why he did it, but the president said that. The second point is now that red line dramatically reduces our flexibility and credibility. In the press conference 2 days ago at the White House, an American reporter asked the president, standing next to the new South Korean president, does this undermine the sense of credibility and commitment on the part of the United States toward friends and allies if you declare a red line once and back away from it? Third, the nightmare scenario Wayne just mentioned of extremists getting access to chemical weapons is something that we really, really, really don't want to have to start dealing with in any serious way. It'll make prior examples of terrorism, even close to home, look like child's play if we get into that kind of environment. That's why this issue has, existential is too strong a word, immense significance for the United States and all its friends and allies on a global scale.
So pay attention, even if you're not going to get involved in the way that John McCain and others may want us to get involved. Pay attention.
This is not an argument to move American forces into the region. It is an argument. We have to get this right using whatever it takes, whether it's covert stuff or whatever it is. We cannot allow those weapons to get out of Syria into the hands of extremists.
Red line, Sarwar.
Well, I couldn't agree more with my friend Bill that the red line was a really unstrategic move
by the
president.
Just remind us what he said there, because it was a while ago.
Well, it's a little hard to recall exactly what he said, but I think what he said was that the use of chemical weapons is a red line, and if they're used, then his calculations or the equation that he's using to determine whether he should intervene will change.
He said, if those weapons are moved or used, it will change my strategic calculus.
My strategic calculus. And people have interpreted the strategic calculus. Gosh, how do you remember all that, Bill? So we don't really know what that means. Now, I just want to remind your readers that we've recently become a convert to chemical weapons equals red line. I mean, the Iraq-Iran war is not that far away, and Iraq used chemical weapons, and the United States was still supplying them satellite intelligence information to hammer Iran. So just want to put that a little bit in perspective. Now, General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, points out that there are 60 to 70 locations that we know probably have chemical weapons stored in Syria. He said, we don't know exactly where they are. So he said, if you ask me to go take them out, I'm paraphrasing, he said, how do I do it?
Right, and they might have been moved,
they
too,
might
given
have been
all the
moved.
Turmoil
Do
there.
We put boots on the ground? Does the U.S. Army go in there to get shot at? And by the way, he's also pointed out that the no-fly zone would be highly ineffective because only 10% of the casualties are done by fighter planes and bombers. And so you have 90% of the people who are killed by direct fire. So even if we had a no-fly zone, then we would still need to do something else, which brings us back full circle. But that's a red line. I think the president was forced to using it. Thankfully, he didn't make it crystal clear that we'll do X if this happens. And I think that's all good.
And he did it in the middle of a campaign. And so this is, and I'm sure Wayne's thing wants to jump in here, that there's a domestic political calculation, and that's fair enough.
Yeah,
and
go ahead, Wayne.
That's all true. But to Bill's earlier point, when a United States president says this and then doesn't act on it, right, in a timely manner, that's a credibility problem. That's a serious, to me, failure. I am not for us going in or doing anything dramatic in Syria, but I think the moment you draw lines in the sand, to really use a really unfortunate analogy, you can't then say, okay, now I didn't really mean that, but now I'm drawing a new line in the sand. Your credibility really depends on using your language smartly, and I don't think the president did in this case.
Last thoughts, Sarwar, from you, and I'll go to you too, Bill and Wayne.
I just want to inject this thought that we've all been talking about this becoming a religious Sunni Shia issue. And I want to play a little bit of a contrarian there and push back. I think the overall issue here is a geopolitical issue because Sunni and Shias live in the Far East. They live on the Indian subcontinent. That, yes, there are Sunnis and, yes, there are Shias, but that is not the overriding issues. And I think we get ourselves into alleys and byways dealing with this issue if we think of that as being the paramount issue. That's a second-order issue.
Second, what's the first order issue then?
The first order issue is the geopolitics of it, that China and Russia find this an easy way to balance the equation with the United States. And the other part of it is we need Russia. We have 60,000 troops in Afghanistan. We have 10 years worth of war material. They cannot go through the port of Karachi because of all the problems. Pakistan, they have to go through Central Asia up north, and Russia controls that. So we need Russia. And secondly, Libya, both China and Russia say, hey, you guys fooled us. You said this was going to be a moral, life-saving issue. You went in there and made it into a regime change issue. So that's what the real problems are. Otherwise, it's a second-order effect.
Wayne, what do you think? Your last thoughts there.
Yeah, I don't see an easy solution to this. I am increasingly concerned that Assad is becoming more desperate and that that can bring in countries like Israel. I'm very concerned about Jordan. The refugee problem in Jordan is having a major destabilizing effect there. I mean, these are the kinds of dominoes that could fall that really create a much broader problem in the region. So I do think this bears watching. I know there's no stomach for intervention, but boy, the stakes are pretty high in this part of the world.
Yeah. Bill?
I'd make a couple of concluding points. To me, the strategic mindset of the United States is we have been in recession or economic downturn for 5 years. We've had two wars going on now since 2001. There is no political appetite in the United States, either among the leadership or among the American people, to intervene. On the one hand, there is this geopolitical mix that Sarwar mentioned, and I think he's absolutely right. I think the long-term strategic consequence of the United States of an unraveling of this part of the world, never mind the chemical weapons issues, are things that we really can't ignore. And sometimes in foreign policy, I'm not arguing for intervention, for a variety of reasons, but there are times in international relations and foreign policy when you don't want to do something, but if you don't, the downside consequences downstream can be pretty dramatic.
And so I think bad decisions and worse decisions.
Yeah, and sometimes you'd rather make a bad decision now than have to confront really bad decisions, N years downstream.
All right. Well, guys, tough topic, and I really appreciate you being with us. Wayne, thanks a lot for your time this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wayne Lesperance, Professor of Political Science at New England College, Director of the Center for Civic Engagement. Sarwar Kashmir, it was good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Good to see you. Thank you for inviting me.
Sarwar Kashmiri, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center, Adjunct Professor at Norwich University. His book is called NATO 2.0. And Bill Martell, thank you also for your time.
Always my pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
William Martell, Associate Professor of International Security Studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. His most recent book is called Victory in War. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.